biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, this station, or its sponsors.
Welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for a half hour each weekday morning, taking your calls. Our last 2 weeks were interrupted on Thursday of each week by having holidays, and so we only got four-day weeks last week and the week before. We're back to our normal five-day-a-week schedule, and we're planning to be live every day. And if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, this is one place where you can call if you'd like to ask and discuss them. If you have a different viewpoint from the host, you're always welcome to call here and discuss it. The number to call is 800-227-5278. That's 800-227-5278. Now, I'm beginning a series in our Temecula meetings, which occur only once a month on Saturdays, one Saturday a month, and this coming Saturday is that Saturday this month, called Making Sense Out of Suffering. Now, more Christians need to hear this series than probably know, because suffering is one of the greatest stumbling blocks to people's spiritual lives. In fact, to tell you the truth, if you read the books by atheists, one of the main reasons for being atheists is because of suffering, because of injustice and pain and suffering of innocent people and things like that. And of course, there's that old line, you know, that if there was a good God who is all powerful, then there wouldn't be this kind of suffering. And not only atheists, but Christians sometimes struggle with this, especially with suffering in their own personal lives, wondering, you know, what's wrong? How come I thought I was a good Christian? How come I lost my child? How come I had a bankruptcy? How come I got this disease? Why am I suffering like this? I thought I was being a good Christian. I paid my tithes. I've done everything I'm supposed to do. And people do stumble because of suffering. And yet, the Bible is not at all shy or reticent about talking about the prevalence of suffering in the life of godly people. Job, Joseph, the apostles, Jesus, Jeremiah, you name it, almost all the Christians in the New Testament, and certainly many of the Old Testament saints, suffered a great deal. And it was not only something that didn't conflict with their belief in God, it was something that played a role in their lives and in God's dealings with them. Now, if you are suffering, or know somebody who's suffering, or don't know how to suffer well, or maybe you've even lost your faith because you suffered in the past, you really need to learn what the Bible has to say about this. And I'm going to be teaching a four-part series. This will be 4 months. It'll be one Saturday night a month in Temecula. The series is called Making Sense Out of Suffering. And the first of those lectures will be this Saturday night. The second one will be a month later on a Saturday night. So it doesn't happen every week. But if you can schedule your next 4 months to attend these meetings, it will be to your spiritual advantage. And that's starting this Saturday night in Temecula. Now, by the way, those who have come to our Temecula meetings in the past know that we've been meeting for a couple of years in a little schoolhouse. We're not meeting there anymore. We're meeting in another location, so you'd have to go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and go to the link that says Announcements, and there you will find the location. It's actually the Harveston Center. Harveston Center. It's a nice little community building in Temecula that we're renting for the purpose. So this Saturday night, 6:30 at the Harveston Center, the address and map can be found at our website, thenarrowpath.com. Beginning the series, Making Sense Out of Suffering, you should come. And I look forward to seeing you there. We're going to go to the phones now. Remember, our line is can be accessed at 800-227-5278. That's 800-227-5278. Our first caller today is Dwight calling from Denver, Colorado. Dwight, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Yes, my question is out of Genesis 1, verse 26, where God told Adam, or God said, let us make man in our own image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds and over the cattle and over all the earth, etc. am I understanding this correctly, that it was never God's intention that man was to rule over other men, but just the God's creation?
That's a good point, because although we do read about dominion being given to man at the time of creation, this dominion is not described as being dominion over societies or over other people. And therefore, it could be said that he's really only talking about having dominion over nature or over, you know, the animal and plant realms. And to try to extend this to some kind of a dominion theology where Christians would rule over whole societies and, you know, force them into a Christian mold would seemingly go far beyond what the passage would justify. Now, I'm sure that since God did tell Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply, and therefore there would be other people. In fact, the original other people would be their own children. Certainly, God intended for Adam and Eve to govern their household, at least until their children were mature. Children need guidance and so forth. So there would be something of a dominion, we might say, or a ruling over their household. And even Paul said that those who manage the church should be men who know how to manage their household, who rule their households well. So there is such a thing as exercising authority over other human beings in certain settings, in certain institutions, the family being the primary one, obviously. Now, you know, how much God anticipated there being, you know, corporations and people employed by other people, or governments where people ruled over other people, we don't know. God, of course, has foreknowledge. He knew those things would develop, but whether he really thought that was something that would be a good or a bad development, we don't know for sure. We do know that when he made Israel, initially he did not give them any kings over them, only himself.
Right.
And when he did raise up leaders, they were not kings. They were judges. They were deliverers. And they served Israel, and then they died, and they left a vacancy, and no one took that vacancy because there was no office of king to be occupied in Israel for about 300 or 480 years. And so when Israel decided they wanted a man to rule over them, this displeased God, as we know from 1 Samuel chapter 8. And it says in Hosea, when God looks back on that fact, he says, I gave you a king my wrath, and I took him away in my anger. God was displeased that they wanted to have a man rule over them. In fact, when they asked for that, God told Samuel, they've rejected me, that I should not reign over them. So, as far as God wanting people to rule over other people, it looks like that's not plan A for God. Seems like it was not when he gave man dominion over the animals and so forth. It did not include the sanction of reigning over other people in a political sense, although insofar as a family unit is a political unit, there is some, obviously, authority structure there. There are settings where persons should do the bidding of other people, and especially children to their parents.
Right. I wonder if that changed at all after the flood when capital punishment came into existence.
Well, it wouldn't have to, necessarily. It's true that dispensationalists speak of that that transition after the flood. They call it the dispensation of human government, because capital punishment was required. Those who shed man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. But it doesn't say by government officials. In the early stages, when the law was given by Moses, and this is before Israel had any kings, it would appear that the execution of people who committed capital crimes was done by the community. That, for example, the example of a of an insubordinate son who was, a threat to the society and to his parents. His parents were supposed to turn him over to the community's justice. And there wasn't a judge or a police force or an army or a king or anyone who executed him, that the whole town would stone him to death.
Right.
That sounds pretty barbarian to us in modern enlightened times, but the point here is that when somebody does something worthy of death, initially the law did not necessarily require that there be sanctions for it, that is, government power to do it, but the community would do it. On the other hand, the law of Moses does mention magistrates, people coming to the magistrates to solve their disputes and so forth.
Right.
If a man accidentally murdered another man, he could flee to the city of refuge. And in the city of refuge, there were magistrates, judges, who would hear his case. And if they decided that it was an accidental murder, they'd let him stay and no one could hurt him. But if they decided that he had premeditated, they put him outside the city of refuge. And there the family of the deceased could have their way with him and kill him. And so, again, the execution in some cases was by the next of kin or by the community, but not necessarily by a police force.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much.
Okay, Dwight. And by the way, I just want to say that in the New Testament, of course, we have it slightly different because the church doesn't take criminal justice into its hands like Israel did. Israel was a state as well as a worshiping community. The church is a worshiping community, but it's not a state. And therefore,
right.
We don't take state powers upon ourselves. And so Paul indicates that since the church isn't a political state itself, but instead dwells under the umbrella of many different political entities, because we're in all countries and they all have their own political
right.
systems, Paul indicated that we should recognize the secular political systems of the lands we live in as what God has ordained to execute criminals now. So whereas Israel, which was a theocracy, carried out capital punishment at the hands of the community or the next of kin of the deceased or whatever, in a secular world where the church is a minority and not ruling the country, we are to recognize that God has ordained these secular powers to do the execution. So although I mentioned that the law of Moses did not set up a police force to do the killing, that doesn't mean that today that we should not recognize such, because the New Testament
right,
does have
right.
a slightly different teaching about that.
Yeah. Quickly, I'm having trouble getting on the Bible Forum. Is there somebody I can talk to or email or something to get on
there?
What is
the problem you're having?
Well, not remembering it specifically. I think it says something about I put my email in there and they say, well, this email is already on here. And then consequently, it won't let me go forward.
Had you registered before?
I think I have, and that's what it keeps saying. You've already registered, but I don't know how to get on it. So I just wonder if there's somebody I can talk to get.
I'm not a techie at all. The guy who runs that forum is in Texas. He's probably listening to the program. If you want to email me with the problem and just
okay.
what you told me right here, I will forward it to him, and he can probably get you logged on.
And your email is on your website?
You can email me at steve@thenarrowpath.com.
Okay. Thank you, Steve.
Okay, Dwight. Thanks for your call.
All right. Thank you.
Bye now. All right. Our lines are open. If you'd like to be on the program, if you have a question about the Bible or the Christian faith that you'd like to ask, or a difference of opinion you'd like to express, this is your golden opportunity. The phone number, I just gave my email address, the phone number to reach me here is 800-227-5278. That's 800-227-5278. Linda wrote to me and said, Steve, if indeed God can't look upon evil, as it says in Habakkuk 1:13, why is he able to have audience with Satan in the book of Job? So in the book of Job, we have this conversation taking place between God and Satan. They're discussing Job and what's going to happen to him. It's very clear that God has no problem facing Satan, And yet in Habakkuk 1:13, it says that God's eyes are too pure than to look upon evil. And so Linda's wondering, how do we harmonize that? Satan is certainly evil. How did God look upon him? Well, I think this comes with a misunderstanding of what is really being affirmed in Habakkuk 1:13. Habakkuk is not saying that God can't see evil or that God can't bear to be in the presence of evil. After all, the Bible teaches that God is everywhere, and evil seems to be everywhere too. Everywhere that evil is, God is there, and he certainly sees it. In fact, the Bible, in a number of places, says, "The eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good." So certainly God looks at evil. God can see evil. God is in the presence of evil because he's in the presence of everything. He's omnipresent. So what does Habakkuk mean when he says God's eyes are too pure than to look upon evil? To look upon is a Hebrew word that means, in this case, to countenance or to look favorably upon, to look with approval on. To look upon somebody doesn't just mean to see them with your eyes, but in a number of contexts in the Bible, in the Old Testament, to look upon someone means to look upon them favorably, to countenance them, to approve them. And so Habakkuk is saying that God's eyes are too pure than to countenance or look favorably upon evil. The context, of course, is that the Babylonians were going to destroy Jerusalem, and God revealed that to Habakkuk. Habakkuk thought, well, you know, we're bad people. I understand that. We deserve judgment. But hey, from the Babylonians, give me a break. These guys are worse than we are. How can you favor the Babylonians when they are so evil? And that's what Habakkuk is saying. Your eyes are too pure to look favorably upon the Babylonian evil, because it seemed to him that God was taking the side of Babylon against Jerusalem. And while Jerusalem was bad, Babylon was worse. And it just didn't seem to Habakkuk that was consistent with God's holiness. Why would he favor Babylon? Well, God told Habakkuk, of course, well, I don't favor Babylon. I'm using Babylon as my tool to punish Jerusalem. Babylon will be punished in due time as well. And so Habakkuk's statement is not even necessarily intended to establish some kind of a doctrine. He's assuming, certainly, God, you can't favor evil. You can't look favorably upon evil. You can't countenance it. So how come you're allowing Babylon to do what they're doing? They seem to be, you know, in the ascendancy against your people, Israel. How can you countenance such evil people as the Babylonians? So that's what he's saying. He's not saying that God can't look at evil. Of course, God looks at evil. He looks at everything, and so it would be reading much too much or the wrong thing into Habakkuk 1:13 to take it that way. Yes, God can meet face-to-face with Satan. He does so in Job. He does so in Zechariah 3. Jesus himself, you know, had direct temptations from Satan in the wilderness and so forth. So that would be how we'd have to understand that, I think. Johnny from Hemet, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Hi there.
Hey. So I'm calling just because I've pretty much stopped going to church, but I really want to go back. And the reason why I stopped is because the churches that I'd go to, the pastors would, you know, pray to Jesus. And they'd ask Jesus for things. And I'm more in search of a fullness of God. And I feel like I'm more confused right now. I feel like Christianity is going in search for Jesus. And I have an understanding of Jesus and who Christ is and what he's done for us. But I'm in search for more of a fullness of God. And I just hope maybe you'd be able to explain.
Let me say, I think that the objection you have is not what I would consider be sufficient to abandon churches over, though I understand somewhat what you're saying. Now, you have to understand that Paul said in Colossians 2:9 that all the fullness of the Godhead dwelt bodily in Jesus. So, you know, the pastors who are praying to Jesus, they are no doubt thinking of him as the manifested the manifestation of God, as we understand him in the incarnation to be. But on the other hand, I understand your position. Jesus never came to exalt himself, but his Father. He said, I didn't come to do my will, but my Father's will. He said, not my will, but thine be done, he said to the Father. He said, when you pray, say, our Father. He said, no one comes to the Father except through me. Jesus' emphasis was on the Father, not on himself. Sure, Jesus made important statements about himself and about how you can't really come to the Father except through him, but the point is, it is the Father that you're coming to.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus didn't come into the world to replace the Father, but rather to introduce us to the Father, to bring the prodigal sons back to their Father. That's what Jesus came for. And so I understand what you're saying. Sometimes people get so wrapped up in Jesus himself that they miss what he came to introduce us to, and that is our Father. And so that is a deficiency in emphasis in some churches. Now, some churches might have the opposite deficiency. They might just talk about God in a generic sense all the time and not give Jesus his proper place. Obviously, if we're going to be biblically balanced, we have to know, you know, how much to focus on the Father and how much on Jesus, and to put them both in the proper relationship that the Bible does. And I think many churches have this difficulty that I think you've described, is that the Father is kind of vague to them, maybe even scary. Some people don't like to think about God as a Father because they've known some earthly fathers that were pretty, you know, they have negative reactions to. They've had some bad fathers, and they don't like to think of God in those terms. They think of Jesus, he's the nice one, he's on my side. The Father's a big ogre who likes to strike people with lightning bolts as soon as they step out of line. Don't want to have much to do with him except it with Jesus, as was angry, and Jesus was on our side and said, God, please give me a chance to save these people so that you won't have to hate them so much, you know. No, it's God who loved the world. It's he that said, listen, I want these people to be saved. Jesus, I want you to go do this for me. And Jesus said that he died on the cross because he loved the Father, because he was doing the Father's will. He was rescuing searching out the lost sheep of the Father to bring them back to him. So churches do need to recognize that and emphasize that, and I see what you're talking about. And the Bible nowhere tells us to pray to Jesus, certainly. It tells us to pray to the Father. Even Jesus told us to pray to the Father. The fact that many Christians pray to Jesus is probably a mere oversight. I mean, obviously, Christians recognize Jesus is God, so it doesn't seem like there'd be anything wrong with praying to Jesus. And I don't think there is anything wrong with it. It's just not taught in Scripture. And it seems to me, when it comes to affairs of relationship with God, we really ought to go by the Scripture as much as possible, because without the Scripture's light, we're pretty ignorant of what we're supposed to do. But I think that you need to be looking for not so much people who use the right words in their prayers, but people who are following God through Christ, people who are disciples of Jesus Christ, seeking to please and glorify God in their lives, and fellowship with them. And if among them there are leaders who, you know, don't use the right words when they pray or whatever, I wouldn't see this as some kind of idolatry or worshiping a false god on their part. I would just say that they're equating Jesus with God, and there's a sense in which the Bible authorizes that. I wouldn't be too picky about that. I understand the objection. And if the pastors don't know that they're supposed to introduce you to the Father and they neglect that, well, you can still pursue the Father and fellowship with other Christians too, and maybe your life will gradually bring some breadth of understanding to them as well. Johnny, I'm running out of time, and I've got other calls to take, but I'm sorry you're discouraged with the church, but, you know, we need to be very gracious to Christians who disagree with us and who we think are deficient, because we expect them to be gracious with our deficiencies. We all have some. But, brother, I do appreciate your call.
Appreciate you. Thank you very much.
All right. Goodbye. Okay, Brad from Kuski, Idaho is next. Brad, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
You know, on that first question you got today, it seems to me like on 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13, if I read it in the Greek, it seems like it's saying, therefore, submit yourselves to the whole creation of mankind. What do you think about that, me interpreting it that way? So I'm saying that government is part of the creation of mankind, taken from First Peter.
You're right. First Peter 2:13 in the King James says, subject yourself to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. And the word ordinance, though, as you point out, in the Greek, the Greek word ordinance there actually means a divine institution or a divine creation. And so if we took it literally, say, submit yourself to every divine creation or divine institution among men. And then he goes on and says, to kings as supreme and to those, you know, ministers who are sent by them. It does seem to indicate that governments exist as part of God's institution or as God's creation.
God's creation of mankind. What is that, you think? See,
well, the word, it could be. See, it sounds like it in English, but the Greek word actually means a divine institution. And so a divine institution of man, that which would mean, I think what I would understand it to mean would be something that God has ordained and God has instituted among men, that is, among human society. It's awkward. The way it's worded is awkward, and it could possibly be taken differently.
Well, the word right before ordinance is in the New King James is every, but when I look it up, it could mean the whole. So submit yourselves to the whole creation of mankind.
And what would that actually, what would that suggest? I mean, I'm not sure what that means exactly.
I'm thinking that it means that government is created by God as part of mankind, just like the family unit is created by God as part of mankind, just like husband and wife, marriage is part of the creation of God. So,
well, that could be true. Of course, they didn't have governments per se. Until, of course, several generations after Adam and Eve. So, you know, how God intended people to be governed at the moment of creation is not clarified. We do know that the first person to build a city, which seems like a political institution, was Cain. But then there was the city of Jerusalem, which was, a godly city under David. So it seems to me that, governments could be seen as something God intended to happen. Unfortunately, we're out of time. This is a very short program in the morning, and so we're going to have to stop there. But we'll be back tomorrow morning, Lord willing, at the same time. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio expenses to stay on the air, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of KBRT, its ownership, its management, or its sponsors.
Thanks for taking time out of your day to join us here on KBRIGHT for The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. And when you hear Steve talk about the teaching that he has available on thenarrowpath.com, if you want to see what's there, make sure you set aside quite a bit of time. There's a ton of material. I think the count's upwards of 900 lectures, studies, debates, topical explorations of key biblical doctrine. Steve's been busy for the last few decades. Best of all, everything is free. He doesn't sell anything on the site or even push for a donation. It's just free. Definitely take advantage of all that's there. Now, that's thenarrowpath.com, but I do have to add, it does cost Steve a lot to be on the air for the Narrow Path program, and that's where you can help. Please pray about an amount you could give each month for 6 months. That would help the Narrow Path get fully listener-supported, which is the only way he can stay on KBRIGHT for the long term. You can get on board with that at thenarrowpath.com.
Transforming talk radio for all of Southern California. KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa and KNSN San Diego. Also on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled The Value of Spending Time with God. There are a lot of things around you today that desire your attention, like family, work, and technology, just to name a few. All these things want to be first in your life, but where is God in all that? God desires your time immensely.
He wants to spend that time with you to talk and listen to you and to encourage you. All those other things that want your time can be frustrating and stressful. But if you learn to spend time with God first, He will give you the strength to face anything that may come your way. In today's teaching, Joyce will show you the importance of time with God and the impact it can have on your life. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, The Value of Spending Time with God.
I'm excited about sharing the Word this morning, and I've got more message than I've got time, but I'm trusting God to get out the very best part for you. For those of you who haven't been here, I've been doing a series that we've just been calling Making Good Habits and Breaking Bad Habits, trying to get the point across that a lot of the times that we think are just problems that are way over our head and just deep bondage and things that we need some kind of a supernatural act of God to get free from, I think a lot of them maybe are just bad habits, things that we've done repetitively over and over and over and over again until they're so ingrained in us that they feel to us like bondage. But the truth of the matter is, with God's help, and only with God's help, you can break up with any bad habit and you can form a new habit to replace that. If you believe that you are helpless, and we are helpless in that we can't do anything apart from God. And that type of helplessness really is a place of power.